Good morning. I hope all is well with you. What do you want to talk about today, huh? There is plenty going on. 12 minutes after 6. You can join in at 770-5633, 770-KMED, the email Bill at BillMeyerShow.com. Sure, I'll be your Facebook friend there, too. And would love to converse with you about the issues of the day. Just so you know who we have coming up, we're going to talk with a gentleman at 635 from Cause of Action. It's a government accountability group, and they're talking about a need to really get a culture of accountability in the federal government especially, and protection for whistleblowers. Technically, there are whistleblower laws, federal whistleblower laws, but people tend to get bounced out of their positions in spite of this. So we'll talk about that a bit at 6:35. And we have a new person this morning filling in for Detective or Lieutenant Mike Boudreau this morning. Was it Josh Reimer? Josh Reimer is going to be coming in for Crime Stoppers, and we're going to be going more into this this amazing theft, $70,000 in coins and watches, and this from the home in Williams. Just amazing. Of course, I must tell you, I can't imagine hanging up some shadow boxes on the walls, though, that had $70,000 worth of coins and watches in them. But, you know, maybe you think you have security in hand. I don't know. It's just one of those. But still, it doesn't explain what's going on. So they're looking for this suspect. And Derek Sewell, I think, is the suspect in this case. And we'll talk more about that at 7:35. State Representative Richardson on the case at 8:10 this morning. And we'll be talking about the e-board, the emergency board meetings. He's right in the thick of this, given his, being on the Ways and Means Committee. And let's see, the latest, speaking of the economy, the quarterly revenue forecast out yesterday. And let's see, Mr. McMullen, economist Mark McMullen, tells a panel of legislators, we are looking at a steady slope of growth. This in the Oregonian this morning. Says the problem we're seeing is that growth is not equal opportunity across all regions. Once you get an hour south of the Columbia River, we've seen no job gains since this summer. So the quarterly revenue forecast is kind of a partly cloudy situation. Of course, could have asked folks in Eugene and Medford and Grants Pass. Yeah, there are two Oregons. There is the Oregon, which is concentrated around Portland and around the tech center. And around the center, frankly, of government power, which I think is why Portland tends to do a little bit better. Look at Washington, D.C. Everybody else starves, but the closer you get to Washington, D.C., the more you get closer to the lobbyists and the people pushing the levers of power. Magically, the money seems to flow there. Isn't that interesting? Maybe if there was a way to turn the money spigot off on Portland. Now, this is not one of those situations where I want to see everyone suffer, where I want to see everybody in Oregon suffer equally. That's not the beggar thy neighbor sort of approach. But the reason the rest of the state starves in contrast to Portland is not just because Portland is home of the smartest, most enlightened people. But remember, there is a certain political bent. It's where the political power, northern part of the state, Willamette Valley, lies. Government projects will tend to flow there. Government largesse will tend to flow there. While at the same time, these individuals of a liberal bent, shall we say, lock up the rest of the way that the state can generate wealth, lock it up in a theme park mentality. No, we can't log. No, we don't want to mine. No, we don't want you fishing. No, we don't want you doing any of this sort of stuff. And these individuals vote in and elect people that implement those kind of anti-human policies. Everything's working fine for Portland. I don't know, maybe the key of getting the boot of tyranny off of Southern Oregon, land use, resource use, all the rest of it, is to hope that Portland suffers and dies. not die literally, but you know what I'm getting at? You start wondering if that's the case, because as far as folks in Portland are concerned, things are fine. You get stimulus dollars coming in from Mordor on the Potomac, Washington, D.C. We're okay. Well, who cares if no one's cutting trees? I want to be able to look at trees when I when I leave Portland in my Prius. Yeah, that sort of thing. There's a bit of that mentality going on. I think there's a lot to be said for that. It's okay for us. We're fine. We don't have to worry about farms and things like that because, well, I remember Commissioner Don Skundrick said, you know, all food comes from Costco. No, he didn't say that, but we were talking about, you know, trying to get more local farms. And I'll always remember in the in these candidate forums a couple of years ago, what was it? Oh, we can always get food at Costco. Oh, you got to love it. Funny, funny world. Funny world. Let's see. So we have the economy kind of, you know, in second gear in the state of Oregon, better in Portland and elsewhere. It's a problem. So they're going to start the meetings today. Cuts could be hitting prisons and state police. We'll talk with State Representative Richardson at 8:10 about that. Well, look what Tribune's reporting this morning. White City Seed Center is going to be closing. Another 25 jobs. White City Garden Seed Distribution Center. Ferrymore Seed. Filing a letter of intent with the state and Medford Mayor Gary Wheeler yesterday saying the company plans to close its distribution center on Agate Road. I'm really sad to see this. The company had been purchased by Seed Holdings Friday. Termination of 200 employees around the nation, or 50% of the company's total workforce. And those not getting fired are going to be offered employment in other places, apparently. I'm sad to see it. It's that company just across the street from Cascade Auto Recycling. So it's all locked up right now. And Ron Fox, in the article here, Executive Director of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development said that SoReady will market the 100,000-square-foot building to prospective buyers looking for large industrial space. Yeah, it's a large industrial space. There's probably quite a few of those around here. At some point, I think the people will say they've had enough. And then every time an environmentalist lawyer wants to file a lawsuit, they'll be taken out and tarred and feathered. It'll probably get to that point. I was reading a editorial piece or an op-ed piece on Lou Rockwell, which kind of reminds me. I don't have it in front of me right now. But the blogger got me thinking about something. You know, we're always railing about what government is doing to us, and yet government is supposedly of, by, and for the people. And this blogger raised an interesting question. He said, did I ever consent to be governed by these people? That's a really interesting point. Let me find that piece. I'm going to go to it right now. Yeah, Roger Young. To alter or abolish, question for my rulers. Really got me thinking last night. He writes, "What makes government government? What gives this institution created long before I was born the power and legitimacy to rule my life? Some would say if I object or reject the legitimacy of any government rule over my life, I have the power to alter or abolish it. Do I have that power individually? Can I merely declare this government is hereby abolished as relates to me personally? Can I even alter it only as it relates to me personally? No. I must accomplish this through the political process in elections. I must convince a majority of those now ruled to, quote unquote, vote for this abolishment. But why? America's founding documents include the phrase, we the people. We the people? How can anyone speak for other people without their consent? To take this question further, how can anyone speak for we the people as it relates to people who are yet to be born? And Roger Young writes, if only a relative handful of people created this government that I'm obligated and forced to obey, though I was not involved nor had a choice in creating it, then why can it not be argued that only an equal number of people or less can abolish it? Why should more votes be required to abolish this government just because its ruling area is larger? Is that my fault? Why should I be essentially punished because this government has increased its ruling area and power since it was created? Why must this act of abolishment be done collectively? Who sets the rules and procedures for such an act? And who or what blessed them with the power to set such rules and procedures? Why wasn't I consulted? All governments seem to be collectivist in that none can be altered or abolished without collectivist action by the people. Individuals, through their own means and actions for some reason, don't have this power. Why not? And when I say altered or abolished in this case, I say with respect to that individual only, not the collective. This is blogger Roger Young on Lou Rockwell. I'm told that governments rule by the consent of the people. In other words, only people collectively have that power. Why aren't individuals recognized as having that power? What if millions of people, each on their own, declared absolutely no consent to be ruled by their declared rulers? Would that declaration be recognized? What if the majority of people, each on their own, not collectively, declared no consent toward being ruled by this declared ruler? Would this ruling state then abolish itself? What gives this ruling state the power to determine how its legitimacy is determined, rather than the supposed free people? If the government rules at the consent of the governed, shouldn't it be up to the governed how they declare their consent? I find that very interesting. Roger Young, writing on LouRockwell.com today. I'll just skip to his end piece. It's amazing. I'm going to have to link to this one. William F. Buckley claimed, quote, "It's not a sign of arrogance for the king to rule. That is what he is there for." Oh, really? Who or what put this king in that position? Why can some declare themselves king, but others cannot? Even the revered Aristotle professed, "For that some should rule and others should be ruled is a thing not only necessary but expedient. From the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule." Is that so? What if an individual decides not to be ruled? That is not necessary nor expedient as regards his personal interest. And exactly who does the marking of who will be rulers and who will be the subjects? From whom or what do they get this authority? Roger Young concludes, "Stay angry and suspicious, my friend, toward those who assume such an arrogant position." Amen, brother. Amen, brother. Roger Young. He says he's a freelance photographer in U.S. occupied Texas. Boy, those Texans. I love those Texans. Yeah, but it's interesting. Think about it. I mean, we're always fighting this government that is supposedly us of we the people, right? We're always, the policy is locking this up, locking that up, saying you can't do this. You must do this. You must do that. You must be here. You must pay for this. When were we ever consulted? When were we ever asked for our consent? We're told that just by living on our patch of ground here in Southern Oregon, well, we must be consenting. 770-KMED. Just some interesting thoughts there from Roger Young. Got me thinking last night. Alan, how you doing this morning? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing pretty good, Bill. Speaking about what you're just talking about there, I think I got the answer for Roger. I came across something yesterday through a friend of mine that absolutely terrified me, and it awakened me. And I tried to call you yesterday afternoon to get a hold of you, and I figure you're probably gone. But this is something that I think everybody needs to look at.
What was that?
Okay, this was a video on YouTube. It was you'll have to entitle it AlumaCorp. You know, we're always talking about the Illuminati.
Oh, AlumaCorp. Okay.
Yeah. Have you seen that?
No, I can't say I have. Could you send me a link to that? Because it's hard to watch to talk about something I haven't watched yet.
Okay. I'm gonna send you a link in about 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
And Bill, when you see this stuff, if you, especially now that you're telling me you haven't seen this, Bill, this is going to light things up.
Well, I look forward to that. Well, thanks for that. I guess the point being, though, get back to what Roger was talking about. Who decides who's ruling? Who decides, you know, what you know, the voting situation is going to be? You know, it's almost like we delude ourselves. We delude ourselves that we are being ruled with our consent. Do we not?
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. We delude ourselves. Continually. In other words, as long as we get to march to mark a little circle on a piece of paper every few months, well, we've had our say. And if it doesn't turn out the way we want it to, well, at least we had our say and we have given our consent. Kind of makes me wonder what would happen if we were to have an election and nobody voted. Think about that. If you were to have an election, what would happen if you had in November, we have all these choices. These are the people that are going to be the leader of the free world. Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and all the other third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, and seventh party type people. What if nobody voted? Does this mean that no one is president and we have said we have not given our consent? Maybe the very act of voting ourselves, the very individual act of voting, is giving consent to the system which strips you of your individualism and your liberty. It makes me wonder. 628. Al, how are you on the economy? Welcome.
Well, Bill, it isn't your vote that gives them their power. It's your checkbook when you write that check to them.
Well, yes and no. But think about this, though. The very act of voting is, in a form, giving legitimacy to the concept that they're going to steal from your check. You see what I'm getting at? What if nobody voted for any of these Congress critters or a governor or whatever the case might be? How can they then claim that they have power, that they have legitimacy, that the people have spoken? So I'm just thinking, in many cases, the situation we find ourselves in right now, we continue to perpetuate this enslavement because we vote for all these people and we vote for these things, and yet we're told that the vote is what gives us our voice.
Well, it's just like we are here with Danny Jordan in Jackson County. I tell you what, I'll give you a brand new car, but I'm going to keep the keys and I'll determine where we go.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Appreciate the call there, Al. 629 KMED. Quick break, right back. We'll break for news here shortly. Catch up on what's going on. Talk with Dan Epstein about whistleblower protection for the federal folks. And we have Dan. It's Dan in Eagle Point, right, Dan?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You wanted to talk about, you ended up going to that meeting between the Occupy forces and the Tea Party folks a few weeks ago that was at that church, right?
It was back in April.
Yeah.
And it was basically moderated by Jeff Golden. And the premise of the meeting was that how can both sides come together and agree on a few things, you know?
Uh-huh.
And 90% of the people in the audience were liberals. It was pretty obvious. But I came away feeling a little bit disgusted with the whole thing because I've attended a lot of forums over the years with timber industry primarily, and a lot of this crowd in there is responsible for the demise of our economy in the state, you know, by locking up land and so forth like that, you know. And now they've created this crisis, and now they all want us to come together and get along with each other. And
after the crisis, which has been created by their policies, and that was why I wanted nothing to do with getting involved with that.
I don't want to get along with them, and I'll be civil. That's a given, but I don't want to get along with them because they're responsible for the economy, I think, and the immediate economy that we have right here.
90%. Yeah, 90% of the loaf. Okay, it's almost like three-fourths of the loaf has been consumed. And now what's left? Well, we wish to talk about sharing it, right? We have 25% of it left, and now we're going to share what's there. Let's talk about
I think it's really funny that, you know, people like Jeff Golden, they're involved in the farmers thing, you know, and they want to relax some of the rules on the land around here that they've helped create. You know, I think it's funny, really. It's like poetic justice coming back on the people that got us in this fix.
And like I've been saying, though, maybe one of the problems in the political situation is that I'm getting to the point where maybe we just start saying we stop consenting to being ruled by these individuals. We stop consenting.
Well, it's a war, Bill. And they know how to fight the war really well. They've done it, and they've pushed us around long enough in the state, and we've let them do it, I guess. We voted the wrong way, I guess. We got the wrong bureaucrats in power.
But look, but hold on. Look at that. You said we voted the wrong way, or we allowed certain things to go in.
Well,
we assume right from the beginning that we assume that the way we're supposed to run things is that we vote, and that one vote over 50% means that the 49% has their stuff stolen. See what I'm getting at?
What else are we going to do besides, you know, going out and taking it by force?
Well, first thing is that the drive to decentralize power needs to continue.
Well, sure.
As the big centralizers continue to grasp and grasp, they're reaching the point, like I was mentioning yesterday, that it's diminishing returns.
Well, that's why I'm a Ron Paul supporter, because he's the closest one to my way of thinking out there.
I would agree with you. I appreciate the call, and thanks for bringing it up, Dan. 6:35. We'll break for news. Be right back, and we're going to talk about some federal protection for those who wish to hold the government that we have accountable. Dan Epstein from Cause of Action will be joining me here in a couple. 6:38, 22 before 7. The question posed this morning, are federal whistleblowers being retaliated against by their own agency? Or agencies, as the case would be. Dan Epstein joins me. He's the executive director of Cause of Action. Good morning, Dan. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Dan, could you tell us a little bit about Cause of Action before we get into the topic at hand here?
Yeah, Cause of Action is a group of investigators and lawyers that are here in Washington to expose waste, fraud, and abuse in our government and to use litigation and other tools to fight against government overreach that harms free enterprise and harms civil liberties.
You must have so much work.
We have good business.
It appears that what you've been focusing on right now, just with what's been going on with the GSA. So we do have federal whistleblower protection laws, technically, do we not?
We do, and you know, it's not just a question of whether or not we have laws on the books, but how they're applied and how they're enforced. And actually, I want to say that this week there's a several groups, and actually of interest is one of the groups is started by former Acorn National Board members, and they're actually hosting a conference this week on whistleblower protection. And in fact, what is surprising to me, I was invited to speak at the conference as the kind of token conservative. I spent several years working as an investigator for the House Oversight Committee. And at this conference, these minority and female former whistleblowers from the federal government basically are holding a conference where they've advertised that Obama has conducted a war on whistleblowers. Cause of Action jumped into this fight because with the GSA scandal where Jeff Neely, according to the Inspector General, was retaliating against those who wanted to blow the whistle on fraud. And with this recent CIA, prostitution scandal and revelations that a whistleblower revealed that DEA agents had relationships with prostitutes in Colombia, I think we're now realizing that, number one, it's very important that we make sure that whistleblowers aren't deterred from exposing waste, fraud, and mismanagement in our government. And then number two, we really have to ask, what is this administration doing if it's not protecting whistleblowers? It's ultimately the whistleblowers who help make our government more accountable.
And also helps keep the spending down, and the money goes where it should be. Now, you're mentioning here that according to the Inspector General Brian Miller in one of these articles, a special to roll call that you're in there, Jeff Neely threatened that his employees would be squashed like a bug if they spoke out against the spending over GSA?
Yeah, that's right. Inspector General Miller stated this before the congressional hearing on the GSA scandal. So, you know, Brian Miller could be held in contempt for Congress if he was wrong about that. But it's fairly clear that he's right about that because he said it straight to Congress in a public setting. So you had the GSA administrator basically telling employees, hey, listen, I know that spending $850,000 for a hotel in Las Vegas in a conference and all these other sorts of things is wasteful, But if you tell anyone, if you even exercise your legal right to go tell an inspector general that I'm committing fraud, I'm going to fire you.
So what happens to the administrators that say things like that? Are they not breaching the law in some form or another, or even violating their terms of employment?
Well, there's law in the books that says that if you're a federal government employee and you're looking to essentially blow the whistle, if you're retaliated against for doing that, that's called what's called a prohibited personnel practice, mm-hmm. which is basically to retaliate against whistleblowers. And so you would have the ability to file a lawsuit against the agency in something that goes through the agency process, gets before the Merit System Protections Board, or is something that the Office of Special Counsel can intervene in. Now, that all sounds highly technical, but the truth of the matter is that what groups like Cause of Action have been hearing from former federal whistleblowers is that this process just doesn't work. It's a broken process.
Well, and, let me drill into that just a second. You say that the whistleblower can file the lawsuit. Now, that means then that you have to be able to find a lawyer to take the case and that you would have to have some money. And I'm wondering if that is part of the reason why nobody wants to do this, because it sounds like it would be an expensive process just to get involved here.
Yeah, that's definitely a reason why they don't do it. And the other reason is a lot of these people recognize that, hey, even if I have a quote-unquote right to blow the whistle, when you sue someone or when you file a complaint, you're going public. And ultimately what happens to a lot of these federal employees is, they'll come back to a workplace where everyone around them says, you're basically a squealer. You're basically someone who's not like us, who love getting fat on the taxpayer's dime.
You're not one of the team, right? You're not a
exactly.
team player. All right.
Exactly.
So,
I mean, and if you look at the GSA scandal, look at those GSA videos. It was the culture at agencies like GSA to make fun of the fact that these people knew they were engrossing themselves on taxpayer dollars. That's the culture of a lot of these government bureaucrats. And if you're blowing the whistle on waste and fraud, you're essentially saying that these guys can't spend the way that they do.
Dan Epstein is here, and once again, Cause of Action is his organization, a government accountability group. Now, let me just get your take on this. Were all of these federal agencies clean as a whistle, and then it just all changed with the latest administration? I just can't believe it all happened in the last 2-3 years. True?
Well, I'll say this. Obviously, as government gets bigger and government spends more of our taxpayer dollars, you're going to have more fraud. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, that there's something we know about this administration in particular. What we know is that this administration has chosen to spend more money through what's called discretionary spending. Think about loan guarantees. Think about federal grants to groups like Acorn, to other groups. And it's spending more money through that process than it is through the contract process. And I can tell you this, that when federal employees are going to be on procurement decisions where, a group like Boeing is going to get a federal contract, there's a lot of law that says, that the employees have to be efficient, effective, all these other sorts of things.
Sure.
But if our government is changing, where we have things like, $100 billion plus stimulus programs, where we have, federal grant spending, loan guarantees, all these sorts of things where there's not a lot of law in the book saying that this has to be competitive, you're not just going to get a lot of waste by the entities getting our tax dollars, but you're going to have a culture of noncompliance amongst the federal employees who are charged with enforcing the way that money is spent. And that's what we've seen. So I would actually argue that there's new challenges for this administration because of the way it has chosen to spend money. And I think that this administration did not foresee the kind of waste, fraud, and abuse that could happen internally when you spend in this manner.
See,
I get it.
I understand what you're saying then. I'm going to just translate it in my head just so I understand perfectly. We just have so much money that is very unaccountable, being spent in a very unaccountable fashion. And there's just so much of it under the guise of stimulus and getting the economy going. You just have this huge hopper just stuffed with Federal Reserve cash, so to speak, right? And And so just the very nature of that changes it. Hey, we've got all the money we need. Is that kind of what you're getting at here?
That's right. Bill, let me tell you, let's say you're working at an agency and you've worked there for 10 years. And for your first 7 years working at the agency, you basically were told, hey, look, your job is to spend $150,000 a year on certain grant programs, and they have to be effective. So what you do for your first 7 years is you make sure that the grantees use that money effectively. You know that you have a $150,000 cap and that you have a very good system for making sure that the entities that you give that money to are going to use it effectively. Now you're told that there's a stimulus that just was passed, and you, in fact, have $500,000. But guess what? You're spending that $500,000 to the same grantees. So what are you going to do? You're going to do what you've done for the first 7 years for the next three and give the money to those different grantees. But then what you're also going to say is, hey, look, I have all this money left over. And some political official is going to say, hey, you know what? You can use that money to spend it on a conference. Do you need to, maybe have your grantees attend a conference for training? Do your employees that work under you need to do some more training? Mm-hmm. You're going to figure out creative ways to spend that money, because ultimately, if you don't spend that money, when you submit your agency's budget request back to Congress, they're going to say, oh, well, we need to decrease your budget because you had too much money left over.
Yes.
Your incentive is to get to spend that in any way possible.
So you spend it or lose it. Okay, so.
That's right.
All right.
Think about the kind of perverse incentives that creates amongst our federal government.
This is just amazing, to hear you describe this, how it works then. Is part of that problem also, though, that there has not really been any budget in Washington, D.C. for, what, at least 3 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been a congressionally authorized budget or in fact, any kind of balanced budget amendment. But keep in mind that, while there's not a budget, it doesn't mean that money's not spent. I mean, we get continuing appropriations resolutions, which essentially spend the money. And in fact, in many ways, what it allows for is for the president to have more discretion in how that money is spent.
And more discretion then means a lot more power to political cronies, right? We know that. It's just going to be the way it works. It's human nature, I think, in the political process. So how do you nip this? How do you kind of rein this in?
Well, I think one thing that's happening, and I think the most surprising thing to me, is that you have progressive groups that are advocating on behalf of federal whistleblowers, both current and former, and they're advocating, they're standing behind people like Senator Susan Collins in Maine. She's a Republican, and she's fighting for the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, which is going to give more rights to whistleblowers to blow the whistle on waste, fraud, and abuse. And I think the solution is that we need to get acts like that through. Whether it's any specific act or just the general policy behind protecting whistleblowers, we need to make sure that those things get passed. And I can tell you that, Cause of Action doesn't engage in any lobbying, but one of the things that we've done just from the investigative side is we've sent letters to Obama's budget director. This is a guy, Jeffrey Zients, and he's in charge of ensuring that inspector generals are conducting investigations, and he's also in charge of ensuring that money is being spent in an accountable way. And so we've actually asked him to conduct an inspection and an evaluation, as well as an audit, to make sure that, the federal agencies that are charged with being efficient, effective, and protecting those whistleblowers who blow the whistle on waste and fraud, that they're actually, not being retaliated against. And so we've asked him to conduct an inspection to make sure that agencies are protecting whistleblowers, not retaliating against them.
Have you received any answers back or assurances that this
We have not. And I think that's, it's been weeks now. And, the fact that we've had all of these scandals break, it is some indication that now's a key time for the government to act. Now, I can tell you this, and I think it's not merely coincidental, that Jeffrey Zients at the Office of Management and Budget has just last week sent out a memo to every agency where basically they have to get approval from the agency heads before they spend above a certain amount. I think it's something like $200,000. And so that's a step in the right direction. At least Jeffrey Zients is paying attention to the groups like Cause of Action and paying attention to the scandals that have happened and said, hey, look, I have to do some kind of action to make sure that these agencies are spending their money appropriately. And so it's one thing to basically put out a policy guidance to say, hey, you guys have to go through some more hoops before you waste taxpayer dollars. But it's quite another thing to actually conduct a real audit and evaluation to make sure that, you know, the government agencies are properly structured. And it may ultimately be the case that, hey, we realize we gotta change the way that the agencies do business, because ultimately their profit margin is the American tax dollar.
What about the problem we were talking about earlier, is that a whistleblower wants to say something but would have to find a lawyer to take the case? Are there lawyers within the government system right now that are ready to just step in and do that? I'm just kind of curious if there is a process that could actually get more of this whistleblowing going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing is that you don't need a lawyer to bring a complaint to an inspector general or to actually bring a complaint before an agency. That's an administrative process, and any individual employee who wants to essentially inform someone within the agency about fraud can do that. And in fact, it doesn't have to be a messy legal battle at all. It can be just a question of going to a supervisor or going to an inspector general and saying, hey, there's waste here, and that inspector general or supervisor deals with it then. What often happens is a lot of these employees do that and then get fired for doing that, and then they need a lawyer, which presents, you know, the whole issue of litigation. But I think on the other hand, there's an Office of Special Counsel that's an independent agency, and their whole role is essentially to enforce, you know, employee laws that protect employees and all these other sorts of things. And so in many ways, it's them who's a group of lawyers who can help defend the rights of employees in these cases. So I think, you know, there's a lot of ways of essentially blowing the whistle without necessarily having to get into heated litigation. And ultimately, you know, we don't want heated litigation, because guess what? When the government gets sued, guess who ends up flipping the bill?
Yeah, we
it's
pay
not
for
the government
that too.
Employees.
Yeah.
It's the American taxpayers.
All right. Cause of action, Government Accountability Group, extraordinaire. How do you guys get funded? Do you fundraising, bake sales? I mean, whatever it is. I'm just wondering how you do your work.
Yeah, lots of bake sales. No, you know, we depend upon a diversity of donors, and we depend upon contributions from everyday Americans who are concerned about waste, fraud, and abuse, and like the idea of an organization that's out there to fight for the rights of taxpayers. So you can definitely check us out at causeofaction.org.
All right, very good. Dan Epstein, Executive Director, causeofaction.org. Appreciate you coming on the program. Thanks for working it. Okay, we'll have you back.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again. 6:54 on AM 1440 KMED. We're the station giving you a shot at a year's worth of groceries. Price it right. We've been talking about this for the last few days. 7:30, we are going to have another qualifier get you into that big Price It Right party, which we're going to be having on June 7th over at Lava Bar. Yep, the Lava Sports Bar and Grill inside Lava Lanes, June 7th. And this is just going to be wild, because one person there is going to be, you know, doing price. We'll finally get to the top of it, top of the heap, a year's worth of groceries from Sherm's Thunderbird Market, Sherm's Food for Less, and the Butcher Shop. $1,000 worth of meat and goodies from the butcher shop, $4,000 worth of other groceries, $5,000 for, I mean, what that would do for your cash flow. And by the way, you can sign up at all those locations once a day, and also KMED.com. So do that. Price it right. 7:30 around that, we'll have the next qualifier, and I hope you are it. We're going to check NBC 5 News, the latest from Fox News, more of your phone calls, the finances too.